So this evening, I'd like to speak about the factors of awakening. In talking about the Dharma, in teaching the Dharma, in teaching meditation, in reading about meditation and Dharma, there are a number of words which come up quite often. And some of these words, words which I've used in the last few days here and which you've used in the group meetings and individual meetings, some of these words are words like mindfulness, words like concentration, words like joy, words like... Actually, I haven't used this one yet, I don't think, but it's commonly used, equanimity. So there's a number of words that are used to describe meditation in different ways. And then there's big words, kind of big words that come up. And big words are words like the big E word, enlightenment, and liberation, and freedom. And awakening. And I think it can be helpful to look at these words and to understand what they mean in the context of the teachings, in the context of the Dharma. Because with any word, a word basically is just a few letters put together and then it's given a meaning. And so somebody puts together a few letters and there's a thing there that's called a word, and then somebody takes this bunch of letters and says, well, I'm going to make this bunch of letters mean. And if we agree, then that's what this bunch of letters means. Sometimes we each have our own ideas about what a word means. So a word can be used, and we can have different concepts, different understandings of what it means. And often the same word, and from what I've been told by many friends, this is very true in Hebrew, the same word can have many different meanings. And so in different contexts, a particular word can have different meanings. And so it's helpful, I think, to see if there can be some understanding of what the actual meaning of some of the words is, and in the context, in the particular context. And also, with all these different words that are thrown around in Dharma talks, it can be helpful to see perhaps how they're related. What's the relationship between different words? How are they related to each other? And so I'd like to speak a little bit about this evening. And the Buddha, in his teachings, used a lot of lists. He was very fond of making lists of things. And many reasons for this. I think a main reason being because at the time of the Buddha, nothing was written down. It was dependent on everything being memorized. And a list is much easier to memorize than just a string of words. So by putting in a list, it made it easier for the monks and maybe for the Buddha himself to remember these things, although sometimes I know a list and I can't remember what's in the list. But so it made it easier to memorize, and then it could accurately be passed on from generation to generation. And in fact, for 500 or 600 years after the Buddha died, this is exactly how the tradition was passed on. Lists are also valuable in that, and I think this is another reason why the Buddha liked lists, because they put together a group of words, a group of themes, a group of subjects, and by having them together in a list, there's an opportunity to see relationships, to see how the words and what the words stand for relate to one another. So one of these lists that the Buddha came up with is a list which he called the seven factors of awakening, and also translated as the seven factors of enlightenment. Okay, so here in this title, in the title of the list, we have this word enlightenment, awakening. And so it's probably useful to have some agreement or some understanding of what did the Buddha mean by awakening or by enlightenment. So if we have different ideas of what is meant, then the list is going to have different meanings. So what did the Buddha mean by enlightenment, by awakening? And of course, we could ask people in different traditions of Buddhism and probably get different answers. And we know that any definition, because it's simply, the word is simply a symbol for something bigger, we know that there can very easily be not necessarily disagreement, but different interpretations and different understandings. And I think with enlightenment, there can very easily be different understandings and different interpretations. And for myself, I've tried as much as possible to come to an understanding of what the Buddha meant based on reading the discourses of the Buddha and based on my own experience. And I see in some instances, in some ways, in some places, my experience very much appears to me, at least, and maybe it's delusion, but at least it appears to me to match what the Buddha has said in his discourses. And of course, there are some places where my experience is a little bit different. And in those instances, I generally try, for the sake of inquiry and for the sake of openness, I try as much as possible to defer to what the Buddha said. So what my understanding of what the Buddha meant by enlightenment, to put it as briefly as possible, going out on a limb, I would say that the Buddha, by enlightenment, meant that enlightenment or liberation or freedom or awakening is the ending, through understanding, through insight, of unsatisfactoriness in life, which is caused by greed, hatred, and delusion. So in considering enlightenment, in considering liberation, it's necessary to take into account all of these factors. So some people may say enlightenment is, well, think of enlightenment as being some particular experience, some big flash of experience, some blissful experience, and we have this experience and we're in this blissful state, and somehow this state just stays forever and ever, and for the rest of our lives we're in this blissed out state. No. The Buddha never said anything like that. Any state that comes into existence for any reason whatsoever will pass. Shalom. So enlightenment isn't some blissed out state. It's not some state of mind that we somehow enter into through some practice or whatever and then stay in it forever and ever. Some people will say that enlightenment is simply the end of suffering, the end of unsatisfactoriness. But I would say, from my understanding from the Buddha, that what he's saying is it's the end of unsatisfactoriness, which is caused by, or which is the result of, greed, hatred, and or delusion. And so that has to be remembered. So enlightenment does not mean the end of everything in life which is unpleasant. So even the Buddha, if you walked up behind him and stuck a pin in his backside, would have some reaction. And in fact, in the sutras, in the discourses of the Buddha, there are several places where the Buddha talks about very intense pains in his body. And he talks about his body being racked with pain. And yet, even in the presence of the pain, even in the presence of this pain, he talks about a clarity of mind and a liberation, a liberated mind, an enlightened mind, a freed mind, which doesn't get hooked into this. So enlightenment isn't the end of unpleasantness. It's the end of the suffering, the unsatisfactoriness, which results from wanting to hold on to the pleasant, wanting to get rid of the unpleasant, or simply being deluded and not really knowing what's pleasant or unpleasant. And this liberation, this ending of suffering, comes through insight, through understanding. Understanding of what? Understanding of the nature of things. Understanding of our true nature. So the Buddha gave this list of factors of awakening. So factors which contribute to, factors which perhaps we could say are necessary for, factors which support awakening and enlightenment. Just coming back to this definition of enlightenment, another point, in defining enlightenment as the ending of or the absence of unsatisfactoriness caused by greed, hatred, and delusion, we could look at it, and I think it's a useful way and an accurate way of looking at it. We could say that based on that, the Buddha is saying that enlightenment is not something that we acquire. Enlightenment or awakening is not something to be gained or gotten or acquired. If it were, it would just be another one of those things that we can reach out for and somehow find it and get it and hold on to it and keep it. But it's not that. The Buddha defined enlightenment in terms of the absence of. In the absence of greed, hatred, and delusion, there is the absence of the suffering, the unsatisfactoriness. And so enlightenment is more from an uncovering. It's something which is here and now. But it's covered. It's covered, it's layered over by the greed, hatred, and delusion. And it's kind of like the quote that Peggy used last night from the Dhammapada. She said, quoting from the Dhammapada, what was it? Like the moon, be like the moon coming out from behind the clouds. But actually, the moon doesn't come out from behind the clouds. The clouds move. The clouds move, and as the clouds disperse and move away, the moon is revealed. The moon has always been there, always will be there, but the clouds cover it. And enlightenment is like that. The greed, hatred, and delusion are the clouds which cover the light of enlightenment. And so it's not something to acquire or to gain or to get, but rather it's in the releasing of, in the letting go of, in the ending of the dispersal of the clouds, then it shines. So the Buddha gave this list of factors which support and which contribute to and which are necessary for liberation. The first of these factors, and the Buddha, as I mentioned, made many lists of different things, and it's interesting to see that the first point in so many lists is the same thing, and it's the starting point of the meditation, and that first factor is mindfulness. Mindfulness is the starting point. Without mindfulness, without paying attention, without being attentive, without being aware of what's happening, there's no chance. Mindfulness is just that, paying attention to what's happening in the present moment, being attentive, being awake, being alert. Mindfulness, it's an interesting word. If we break it down a little bit, it's mindful. And in a sense, mindfulness, being mindful of something, means that the mind is full of that. So when we're being mindful of the breath, mindful of the experience of breath, the mind is just with the breath experience, just in that moment. And it's almost like there's no room left for anything else. It's just with the breath. The experience of the breath. So this is mindfulness, and this first factor is mindfulness. And we use the meditation in one sense. Of course, there are many, many aspects to the meditation and many values in the meditation, but one aspect of it and one use of the meditation is to cultivate this quality of mindfulness. It's like learning how to play a music instrument. And at first, it's very difficult. I remember trying to learn how to play the violin. And I remember I was ordered to go to my room and close the door and practice. And at first, it's difficult. It's very squeaky. And same with mindfulness. So when we start with the mindfulness and we bring the attention, of course, there's going to be distractions. The attention will go off. The mind is so habituated and so conditioned to be doing all kinds of things and going all kinds of places, and the mind has very little practice and very little experience, if we look closely, at being in the present. When we start to watch what's going on in the mind, almost all of it is past or future. How much of what we see going on in our mind is right present, right now? And so this is what our mind is habituated to doing. And most of the time we just go along with it because we don't think that there's any other way. And so now we practice. We see when that's happening, and then gently but directly. So not forcing, not pushing, not beating ourselves up. With some gentleness and kindness, but with directness, coming back to the present, coming back to the experience of the breath. And it's like playing the squeaky note on the violin and hearing, and then, okay, try it again, and again. and with any music instrument. And in time, we start to notice some improvement. I think it's helpful to remember that even the greatest musicians, even the greatest violinists, sometimes still, after years and years of playing, sometimes they still make a squeaky note. And so not to expect that it's a process of time, and after some time my mindfulness will be so good that I can just focus on the breath and nothing else, no distractions, no thoughts, no past, no future, just right here with the breath. Mind doesn't go along with that. Mind doesn't agree with that. But nevertheless, we can cultivate a kind of mindfulness, a mindfulness which has somewhat more steadiness, more consistency, more ability to rest with what's happening in the present moment. So mindfulness is the first factor. The second factor is a factor which, and sometimes, and we'll talk a little bit about this, the relationship between the different factors. And the factors are given in a specific order, and we can see a progression in the order, but it's also interesting to see how they interact with one another. And so the second factor is what the Buddha described, or the Buddha used the term investigation of the Dharma. Investigation of the Dharma. Okay, now here's another word that's used very often, and the word Dharma. What does the word Dharma mean? And the word Dharma is a little bit complicated because, like some of the words in Hebrew, it has many different meanings. And Dharma, one meaning of the word Dharma is the teachings. The teachings are the Dharma. Another meaning of the word Dharma is the truth of how things are, the nature of things. And another meaning of the word Dharma is simply things. All things are Dharmas. So the word Dharma has different meanings, and so the Buddha gave the second factor as the investigation of the Dharma. And so investigation of the Dharma can mean the investigation of all of these. It's inquiry into the teachings. What are the teachings telling us? What are the teachings pointing at? It's investigation, inquiry into the nature of things. The nature of who I am, the nature of what life is. It's investigation and inquiry into things, anything. This factor of investigation, the word that I like to describe this, and the word that I generally use for this investigation, is interest. So we can see in our practice, and we can see in our daily life too, just to be mindful of something is helpful. It's helpful to be mindful of something, but it's often difficult to sustain any mindfulness unless we're really interested. When there's real interest in something, then it's much easier to be mindful of it. It's much easier to give attention to it and to stay with it. So interest, this sense of investigation, curiosity, is really important. And this curiosity, this interest, it's helpful if this curiosity and this interest comes from a place of not holding on to any preconceived ideas of what things are or how they should be. And this is a little bit difficult part, because when we start to look, we see that we very often do have preconceived ideas. We start to look for a particular thing. We start to look to make things fit how we want them or how we think they should be. So we sit down in meditation and we think, well, meditation is about being peaceful and being quiet and feeling good. And then I sit down and I just start sitting and the mind is going, and it's, oh, I can't meditate. Something's wrong. I can't do this. And then, okay, I have to make more effort and then try harder. And of course, all of this is just more of the mind going. And so there's an idea of how meditation should be, of what should happen. And the more it doesn't happen, the more frustrated I get, the more upset I get, the more defeated I get, and then I just pack up, forget it. So it's helpful if we can just let go of these ideas. And just thinking, I mentioned it in one of the small groups today, I went one time to a talk, a lecture that the Dalai Lama was giving. And he started, at the beginning of the talk, he sort of looked, and it was a big auditorium, and there were, I don't know, maybe 5,000 people there. And he looked around, and he said, when I give a talk, some people come because they're looking for great words of wisdom. And they're looking for me to say something very wise, and they're looking for enlightenment. And he said, and then he said, and other people come, just some people come, he said, they don't know who I am at all, and they just come because they're curious. And he said, that's the way I like people to come. Just to come not knowing who I am and to be curious. And so with this investigation, if we can bring this attitude of not really having an idea of what we're looking for or what we're hoping to find, but an attitude of just looking to see what is, just a curiosity, an interest. And then this interest gives support to the mindfulness. The third factor is energy. Energy. And this is something which in retreats very often seems to be in low supply. And it's a puzzle to me. And it's interesting that it seems to be in the lowest supply during the last sitting of the evening. And we think, oh, it's been such a long day, it's so late, I just, oh, okay, I'll just nod my way through this last sitting and then go right off to bed. And by the end of the last sitting, just so tired, just hit the pillow, poof, out. And I can't help but think that 9:30, for most of us in our daily life, especially from our short experience here in Israel, 9:30 is not very late at night. and I think of times of spending, times of being a student, and then times of working and spending the whole day studying or going to classes or spending a whole day at work and coming home and just being so tired, just want to veg out in front of the television or space out or go to sleep or something. And then somebody phones and says, oh, there's a really good movie playing. And all of a sudden, oh, yes. Where there's interest, then there's energy. And if we can bring this into our practice, into the meditation practice, if we can bring the mindfulness and the interest together, then the energy comes. And we don't have to force ourselves to stay awake at night a little bit later. We don't have to force ourselves to keep attentive in the meditation. We don't have to force anything. The energy just comes very naturally from the interest. And then, of course, when we have the energy, once the energy is there, then that in turn makes it easier to be mindful. So the interest, the mindfulness supports the interest. The interest sustains the mindfulness. The interest gives rise to energy, and the energy also sustains the mindfulness. And so these three factors work together very much. So we have mindfulness, we have interest or investigation, inquiry, and we have energy. And this is where I start to have trouble remembering the list. But if we think about in our own life, when we're doing something with interest and with energy, when we're doing something that we're really interested in, and there's lots of energy, how do we feel while we're doing it? We feel really good. There's a happiness, there's a joy in doing it. And this is the fourth factor. The fourth factor is joy. And the Buddha certainly intended Dharma practice and meditation to be joyful. The whole idea is to come to the end of suffering. Not to be beating ourselves up and making ourselves suffer more. To come to the end of suffering. So joy. So the Buddha said that joy is an important factor. And we can see when these first three factors are there, joy is very natural. And again, we don't have to look around for it or try and figure out how to get it. It just comes quite naturally. It's a very natural process. And this joy, there can be some misunderstanding of what's meant by joy. And sometimes what can be kind of inserted in here instead of joy is pleasure. And so we can start to look for pleasure, for pleasant sensations, pleasant experiences. And this isn't what is meant by joy here. Joy is simply the delight, a delight in, an appreciation of, a real joy in whatever is happening. And so when we're doing something where there's a lot of interest and a lot of energy, this joy comes up. And sometimes it can even be something that isn't pleasant. And example that comes to my mind right now is bus trips in India. And those who have been to India know. And on the opening evening I talked about the Egged buses, and anyone who was around when I was here in 1971 knows that the Egged buses were not pleasant experiences. I think most of you are too young for that. But riding in a bus in India is not in any way pleasant. It's crowded, it's noisy, it's bumpy, it's dusty, it's hot, it's slow. But in traveling through the Indian countryside, in being in the bus with all the people and seeing the life in the bus and seeing the life in the countryside around, even in the unpleasantness, even in the discomfort, there's still a kind of a delight in it. There's an appreciation for it. There's a joy. And it at least for me, it hardly enters the mind to have it any other way. It's just such a rich experience. And so this joy isn't dependent on just pleasure. Another example that just came into my mind, just remembering when I used to do a lot of my own car repair work. Just thinking of times when I'd be down on the ground on my back under the car and oil all over the place and dirty and a pain in the back and it's cold and the neck is getting tight and it's not at all unpleasant. And yet in doing that, in being able to do that and wanting to do it, there's a joy. And I'm sure we can all think of examples in our own lives of things that we enjoy doing, even though it's not necessarily a pleasant experience. But still there's a delight in doing it. So this is joy, the fourth factor of joy. The fifth factor is one which often seems to come in a strange place. And the fifth factor is concentration. And this is sometimes seems strange, and it's interesting to see the placement of this, because in the meditation, when we come to meditation and we start to meditate, what so easily and so frequently comes to us right from the very start is, my concentration is no good. I can't concentrate. And even though at times, I'm not sure, I haven't kept close track on this retreat, but at times I've really watched myself to intentionally not use the word concentration. And still, people will come to a meeting and say, I can't concentrate. And then I'll say, well, who told you to concentrate? And I say, oh, but that's what meditation is. And so we have an idea of what we're supposed to be doing or what's supposed to happen. And so often with meditation, the idea is that concentration comes first. And before I can do anything else, before anything else, I have to be able to concentrate. And yet here, the Buddha is saying, no, concentration is fifth. Concentration comes later. And if we look at this list, at this series, we can see when we're doing something with interest, the energy comes, and then the joy comes. And when that's there, we can see that the concentration, the focus on it, comes very naturally. The concentration doesn't require struggle and effort and trying and striving and fighting. It comes naturally. And in the meditation, when I do talk about concentration, this is the kind of concentration I refer to. This is what I mean. This kind of concentration that comes naturally. Not this kind of concentration that comes from a tension and a pressure of saying, I must focus on my breath. And just narrowing the focus and using force, using pressure to just trying to block out everything else and stop everything else and just be right with the breath. This isn't liberation. This is imprisonment. Liberation is openness and spaciousness. I often think of memories of seeing in do they have rodeos in Israel? Does everyone know what a rodeo is? And the cowboys put on their show and they do their roping of cows and their horse riding and all these different things. And one of the things that they do in the rodeo is riding on bucking broncos, on these wild horses. And we see what they do to start it is they put the horse in a little tiny pen. And there's barely room for the horse to move. And the horse moves and bumps into the pen and moves a little bit more and bumps into the pen. And it keeps moving and bumping in, and each time it bumps in, it gets a little bit more frustrated and a little bit more angry. And so it moves a little harder and a little harder. And before too long, the horse is really jumping and bucking and tossing around, really struggling to get out of there. And then they say to the cowboy, okay, sit. And the cowboy gets on, and the horse, and they lift the gate, and the horse goes off just jumping, boom, boom, boom. And at some point, the cowboy falls off. And the horse... So while the horse is in the cage, in this pen, he's... And the cowboy is on the horse, gripping him as tight as he can with his knees, and the horse... Cowboy gets thrown off. Horse jumps a couple more times and then stops. When the space opens up, when the prison is gone, the horse settles down. And our minds work the same way. the more pressure we put on the mind to be a certain way, to act in a certain way, or to not act in a certain way, the more it resists, the more it fights. And the more pressure we put on, when we give space, then the mind does its thing, and eventually it gets tired of doing its thing, or it sees that there's no resistance, so what's the point anymore? And it stops. It quiets down. It quiets down very naturally and easily and gently. So we don't have to fight with the mind. We don't have to struggle. To give space. And in that spaciousness, the mind settles and the concentration comes. And it's a kind of concentration which is very focused, but at the same time is very open. So when something comes, there's no disturbance. It just comes and it goes. Shalom. There's no disturbance. So this concentration, which is spacious and which is still joyful and which still has interest and energy and mindfulness. So then when we have these factors, we have the mindfulness, we got the interest, the energy, the joy, the concentration. With all that, we feel this calmness. There is this calmness, this calming down, this steadying. And again, the calmness comes, not because I forced myself to just sit here, but it's come from giving space. This is the hello and the peace, the welcoming. When we're welcoming, when we welcome someone, they're peaceful. They come in and we become friends. If somebody comes up to us and right away we start saying, they don't get friendly. But if somebody comes to us and we say, oh, welcome, hello, how are you? Then they're friendly. And so there's the settling. There's the calmness. The calmness. And so this concentration and this calmness, again, they feed back. When there's calmness, then there's relaxation, so there's more energy. When there's concentration, of course, the mindfulness is much stronger. And so these factors keep affecting one another, and they all interact with one another. So, concentration, calmness, that's the sixth. The seventh one is a factor which, in a sense, ties together all the other six. It brings together all six, and it creates a balance or a harmony. And the seventh factor is equanimity. Equanimity is a very important factor. It's an essential factor. And understanding what equanimity is, sometimes, very often, we get this idea that equanimity means just bland, boring, nothing disturbs, nothing happens. To be equanimous, to have equanimity, means to just be. But that's not what equanimity means. Because in this list, we have to remember that equanimity goes along with joy. It goes along with concentration. It goes along with interest. What equanimity is, equanimity is just the ability to be steady. Equanimity is seeing where the mind is reaching out to grab or to push away and not getting caught in it. Staying steady. The steadiness. Not being pushed and pulled. So when we're when we're in the meditation, we're giving attention to the body sensations, and some sound comes. Equanimity hears the sound, but isn't pulled to it. Equanimity can even appreciate the sound. Equanimity can know that the sound has a pleasant feeling. Equanimity can know that the sound has an unpleasant feeling, but not be pulled into it, not be sucked into trying to get more of it or trying to push it away. So this is equanimity. It's knowing what is and not being pushed and pulled, so that there is a steadiness. There's a kind of steadiness, but a steadiness which is with whatever is. So these are the seven factors that the Buddha described as factors of awakening, factors of enlightenment. And so we can look at this list, and we can look at these factors, and we can look in our own lives, and we can look in our practice, and see, are these factors present? Is the way I'm practicing, is the way I'm living my life, not just in practice in the retreat, but in my life, is my life being lived in a way that's supporting and contributing to these factors? And if it is, then it's living in a way that's supporting and contributing to awakening. And sometimes we can look into our lives and we can look at what we're doing, we can look at something, whatever we're doing, and we could say, okay, here I am, these factors are all present. And I think we all have this many times. These factors are present. I can see that there's interest, there's investigation. I can see that there's mindfulness. I can see that there's the rest of them. And then the question comes, so why aren't I enlightened? Why don't I feel enlightened? Part of it may be because I have some idea of what enlightenment is. And I'm holding on. There's a holding on to some idea. And if my experience doesn't match that idea, then I say I'm not enlightened. But if we go back to the original definition of enlightenment, the definition of liberation, it's through understanding, through insight, understanding the nature of things. And so all these factors can be present, and all these factors are necessary, but if there still isn't the sense of being free, then what may be lacking, what may be necessary, is the insight. And these factors, these seven factors, all contribute to insight. But unfortunately, there's no guarantee, because we never know when insight is going to come. These factors, an analogy that I like that Krishnamurti used, some of you may know, may be familiar with Indian, don't know what, philosopher, teacher, thinker, whatever. He used an analogy. He said that on a really hot day, we can open the window, but opening the window is no guarantee that the breeze will blow in. But if we don't open the window, there's no chance. And so the practice and these factors are the opening of the window. And with the opening of the window, in ways that I don't know if there's any way of explaining or describing how or why, but in some way, in the opening of the window is the possibility of this understanding, this liberating understanding, revealing itself, not through acquiring, not through figuring out, not through thinking about, but simply through opening the window. So tomorrow I'll speak more about insight and about liberating insight. So if we could sit quietly for a couple of minutes now. May all beings live with mindfulness. May all beings live with interest. May all beings live with insight.